This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. 3.5 billion years ago, this planet was a hostile and barren place. The atmosphere was toxic and contained no oxygen, and life on Earth was restricted to a variety of unsophisticated single-celled organisms which lived in the sea. But then a new type of organism emerged, one with an amazing new capability. It could harvest energy from sunlight and use it to fuel its own activities. This phenomenon is known as photosynthesis, and is almost certainly the most important chemical process on Earth. Plants and some other organisms depend on it for their energy, and almost all life is ultimately reliant on it for its survival. It's responsible for the food we eat and the air we breathe, and without it, Earth would still be sterile rather than, as it is, teeming with life. With me to discuss photosynthesis are Sandy Knapp, a botanist at the Natural History Museum, Nick Lane, reader in evolutionary biochemistry at University College London, and John Allen, professor of biochemistry at Queen Mary University of London. Sandy Knapp, would you give us some idea of what photosynthesis is and why it's so important?
Photosynthesis is one of those things that you always read about, you hear about at school. But actually, when you look at it carefully, what it is it's a very simple, elegant chemical reaction which involves an organism taking water and carbon dioxide and, with the help of light, turning those into glucose and oxygen. So it's water and parts of the air turned into sugar and a really important part of the air for us. And the reason it's so important is because without photosynthesis, that blue and green bowl that you see from space would look like Mars.
And can you just develop that a bit, of the importance of it and how it changed things?
Well, when organisms were able to create their own food, to create something from light, that then allowed other organisms to feed on them. So you have autotrophs, which are organisms that make their own food. So plants are autotrophs. Anything that does photosynthesis is an autotroph. We are completely hopeless. We're heterotrophs. We depend on other organisms for our food. So without these photosynthetic organisms, we would have nothing to eat and nothing to breathe. And so all of life really depends upon autotrophs. It's also true, I think, that if you look at photosynthesis, it seems that's the sort of simple end. But you look at the structural diversity of life on Earth, sort of that we have rainforests and we have deserts and we have all these different types of habitats, depends upon the different types of autotrophs which are in those habitats, which then drive the development of communities that are in all the different biomes on Earth.
What are the basic raw materials for photosynthesis? What does a plant, for instance, need in order to photosynthesize?
Well, first of all, it needs water, it needs carbon dioxide, there needs to be light. And there also need to be a few really important minerals. Light is the most important. I would think water is also very important. And carbon dioxide can be in varying concentrations, and that makes a big difference. And I'm sure my biochemical colleagues will be able to tell us about that. But it also needs sort of a few other things as well. Plants need nitrogen and phosphorus to make the enzymes which drive the reactions of photosynthesis. And they also need a mineral called magnesium, which sits like a spider at the center of the chlorophyll molecule, which is what one of the light-harvesting pigments in leaves.
So we're talking about photosynthesis as central part of a little laboratory, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an engine room. It's essentially plant power, is what it is.
Yes. Nick Lane, if we think about, let's stick to plants mm-hmm. all the time. What are the structures in the plant cell that make photosynthesis possible? You don't have to rush. We'd all like to know in detail.
Okay. Well, it all goes on inside a special compartment inside the cell, which is called the chloroplast. Now, the chloroplasts, in fact, were once bacteria in their own right. They were free-living bacteria. We know them as cyanobacteria now. And they became captured, probably something in the order of 1 billion to 1.5 billion years ago, by more complex cells, and they became responsible for photosynthesis. They continued to do what they were doing before.
You say became captured. That sounds terrific, but people like me don't know what you mean.
Well, they were simply engulfed by a larger cell and effectively put to work, not quite as slaves, but they did what they always did. They continued to photosynthesize. They continue to take electrons from water, put them onto carbon dioxide and make sugars that way. And so the host cell, which had captured them, gained those benefits of getting a free lunch, you might say.
Is the throwaway analogy that I said to Sandy a few moments ago, is the idea of it being an engine room, does that make any sense? Is that useful for people?
Do they, no, I think absolutely it's an engine room.
So
yes.
Can you tell us what's happening inside this engine room then? Just tell it again.
Well, we have a series of membranes, they're called the thylakoid membranes, and there's enormous complexes of proteins. I mean, this is one of the difficult things to try to get across, because I say enormous complexes, but this is all microscopic, of course. But if you take yourself down to the size of a small molecule, say the size of an oxygen molecule, these complexes, it's like being in some kind of huge industrial complex. So they're really enormous, and they sit there in the membranes. And all they do at a chemical level is really amazingly simple. All they do is they extract electrons from water and they pass them down a kind of a chain, and eventually they push them onto carbon dioxide to make the sugars. Now, it sounds, at a chemical level, it's very simple. At the biochemical level, it's enormously difficult. And
why?
These complexes... Well, it's not easy to get electrons out of water in the first place. So, you know, the largest storms crashing water against a sea cliff is not going to break water down into its component parts. But light can do that. Now, light doesn't normally do that. Certain wavelengths, so UV light, can split water. But by and large, it requires a biochemical skill, which we can mimic, but with great difficulty, actually. And plants just simply do it. They simply extract these electrons. They pass them down and they push them onto CO2.
They must have evolved to do it over a long period of time.
We don't know
why
exactly...
Why did they want to do it?
That's always a difficult question in evolution. Essentially, water is everywhere. If you can crack that, then you've got your raw material that you need in the oceans. It's surrounding you. The other materials that could be used... things like hydrogen sulfide gas or just dissolved iron, for example. If you have no oxygen around, you can use iron. But they're far less common. Water is the perfect fuel.
The process, as I read from my notes, I'm making a lot of attention to my notes on this program, can be separated into two separate chemical reactions. Can you tell us what those two are?
Well, they're known as the light and the dark reactions. And really, it's at its simplest, the light reaction... driven by the absorption of photons of light, and it's simply stripping electrons from water. So that's essentially what's being powered by the light reaction, is the removal of electrons from water. The waste of this is oxygen, which is just, you know, it's a waste product of photosynthesis. It's just let go. It accumulates in the atmosphere.
Oxygen is a waste byproduct.
It's a waste byproduct, yes. So then the dark reaction, you take those electrons... and you force them onto carbon dioxide. Now, that doesn't require light at all. So it used to be called the dark reaction. They've changed the name recently to non-light reactions, I think. But I prefer the old term, the dark reaction. It can happen in the dark.
It gets more and more mysterious. And the simpler you make it, the more mysterious it also gets. John Allen, at the heart of this process is this molecule called chlorophyll. Now, what's so specific about that? What's so special about that?
Well, interesting to follow Nick, you know, oxygen is not just a waste product, it's a toxic waste product. We don't think of it as toxic. We may come back to that. Chlorophyll.
Tell us why now. You can't tease us like that. I mean, why is it toxic?
Well, 2.4 thousand million years ago, as you said in the introduction, the whole biosphere was working fine without free molecular oxygen. This was dangerous stuff to have around. It's chemically highly reactive. 2.4 thousand million equals billion years ago, this trick was discovered by accident of taking electrons from water, producing this byproduct. This was a big shock to the system. There's never been an equivalent environmental catastrophe for life that existed before that time.
As the
production of oxygen. A poison gas, actually, which... Nevertheless, doing that trick had such immense value, again discovered by accident. It wasn't that they wanted to do this. I know that you were speaking metaphorically there. this was had such benefit that they had to learn to live with this poison gas and learning to live with this
who's
poison
they?
Gas.
Who's the they?
The organism, pretty well everything that had to deal with oxygen as it came along. There are still environments today where oxygen doesn't permeate and there is still anoxic life without oxygen. There was a relic of this former time. Which
is this down in the clefts of the ocean?
Yeah, and under the in the rocks in the lithosphere. Yeah.
Anyway, back to chlorophyll.
Mm. I wasn't evading the question.
No,
then.
I know you weren't. I
just found
I just got interested by oxygen being a toxic waste.
I think it's
makes breathing an entirely different experience.
Well, not to us, of course. That's the chlorophyll. Well, this is one of the follows the time-honoured tradition of giving things Greek names. It simply means green leaf, chlorophyll. It's a chemical substance. It's an organic chemical substance. The structure of which I can describe very briefly. If you, Sandy was right about this magnesium atom at the middle of the spider's web. The spider's web is built up of essentially four carbon atoms, if you imagine them being linked in series, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you add a fifth atom, which is not carbon but nitrogen, and you fold that around to make a circle. It's a five-membered object, pentagon actually. That's a simple circular molecule, which is one of the building blocks. Now there are four of these. It's called a pyrrole, is a technical term. There are four of these in the basic head group of chlorophyll. And these are 1, 2, 3, 4, also arranged in a series. And you fold that around to make a circle. And at the centre of that, with the nitrogen atoms pointing inwards, is the magnesium atom. And that's really chlorophyll, except you just have to add the fact that there's a hydrocarbon tail attached to one of these rings, which gives chlorophyll the property of being completely insoluble in water but soluble in organic solvents, and also its preferred location is within biological membranes, which are fatty, waxy, oily compartments.
And this is what's special and essential about it, is it?
Well, special and essential, I mean, the first thing there really is there's nothing magical about it. You know, in the history of biology, people have always wanted to be focusing down on what's the smallest thing that we can say is alive. And people got very excited about chlorophyll. It seemed to be a very special molecule sustaining life on Earth. But in fact, it's just a chemical. In fact, it's been synthesized by synthetic organic chemists in Harvard University in the 60s or 70s. From scratch, you can make the whole thing, a tour de force of organic chemistry. Plants do this by a chemical pathway.
I'm told that there are two separate sets of chlorophyll involved in this reaction. Is that right?
Yes.
What do they do? How do they do it?
Well, that's correct. They do essentially the same thing. Nick talked about this chain of electron carriers, and a great insight was provided in 1960, in fact, by Hill and Bendel, a paper published in April 1960. They said, in this, first of all, there is a chain of electron carriers. Secondly, there are two points in that chain of electron carriers where the electrons wouldn't go unless they were given a push by some energy input. And that push is provided by light energy acting on chlorophyll. One of the fates of the energy when the chlorophyll molecule has absorbed light is for it to lose an electron. That's the beginning, that's the push that drives this electron transport chain. That special chlorophyll that loses its electron to start the chain is just one of 300 chlorophyll molecules, approximately. All the others take the absorbed excitation energy and pass it amongst each other until it arrives at this special one, and that sets the whole process going and sustains life on Earth, as we've heard before.
Sandy, now we've been talking about photosynthesis as if it were a single process, but there's more than one type. Can you Tell us about that.
Sure. The photosynthesis is there. Most plants are what's called C3 photosynthesizers. And it's called C3 because the first thing that happens to the carbon dioxide when it gets split up is it turns into a 3-carbon molecule. But there's a whole set of flowering plants, and it happens all over flowering plants, which are called C4 plants. And what they do is that is the first reaction is slightly different, and the carbon dioxide gets broken up into a 4-carbon molecule, and then the photosynthesis happens in two different places, two different types of cells. Normally it just happens in one part of the cell, but in C4 photosynthetic plants, what happens is the CO2 is sort of stored, it's sort of packaged into special, they're called bundle sheath cells, and they're around the vasculature, so they're around the veins. If you think about a leaf, it has a set of veins in it, and that's where the water is running up and the sugars are running down, and these special bundle sheath cells is where this carbon dioxide is stored. And C4 plants are much more efficient at photosynthesis at high temperatures. So oftentimes things that grow in deserts and in very hot places are C4 photosynthesizers. And there's a third kind, which is called crassulacean acid metabolism, so CAM plants. And it was first discovered in a sedum, in one of those little rock plants that you grow in rock gardens, which are in the family Crassulaceae. And so it's called crassulacean acid metabolism. And in those plants, what happens is the stomates, which is where the stomates are like little holes in a leaf. So if you take a hand lens and look at the bottom of a leaf very carefully, you see tiny little pits. And those little pits are pores in the leaf, which have two guard cells around them, almost like a mouth that can open and close. And the CO2 goes in through these pores. So crassulacean acid metabolism plants keep their stomates closed during the day. All other plants open their stomates during the day, so this can all go on in the light. Crassulacean acid metabolism plants keep those closed during the day and open them at night when it's not so hot. They do all the business of taking in the CO2 at night and then store it. And so CAM plants can idle, so they can store up all the components for photosynthesis and kind of do it later, which is really useful if you live in a desert. So many CAM plants are things like cacti and orchids and the kinds of plants that live in very hot, dry, stressful environments.
But if they do it in the dark, what do they do for light?
They harvest the light as well, so it all gets stored.
Meaning through
up.
The day they harvest the light.
Mm-hmm.
But you've said they're closed up. They're not all that closed up.
Well, the light comes in through the cells of the plant. So come in. The stomates are what take in the gas. And so C4 plants are very interesting because if you look at the distribution of C4 and C3 plants across flowering plants, many of our major crops, corn, maize, for example, is a C4 plant. And this has been studied the most in the grasses. And these C4 plants are highly photosynthetically efficient. And so one of the great holy grails in agriculture is to take a C3 plant like rice or wheat and turn it into a C4 plant, which would increase its efficiency and thereby perhaps increase its yield and its ability to grow in different parts of the world.
Okay, Nicolai, what does the plant cell do with the energy that it's converted? Can we explain that again?
I talked earlier about the flow of electrons. Now, they do two things. You have essentially a current of electrons, and that is used to drive protons, so the positive nucleus of hydrogen atoms across a membrane. So you end up with a proton gradient across the membrane. Now that's common to all cells.
Gradient, like you mean slope?
Well, yes, essentially on one side of the membrane you have a large number of protons, on the other side you have very few, relatively few. So it's essentially like a hydroelectric power scheme with a reservoir on one side and a turbine in the membrane itself. So the turbine is an enzyme called the ATP synthase enzyme, and that is powered by the flow of protons from the reservoir back to the side where it's downhill, in effect. And that produces ATP. Now, ATP is generally called the energy currency of life. It's used by all living cells. In fact, the ATP synthase as well, which produces it, is also used by almost all living cells. And that powers everything in the cell. You could think of it like a coin in a slot machine. Basically, all proteins, to do any work at all, they change their conformation. And to change their shape requires splitting an ATP. So the current of electrons, which is flowing from water to CO2, is driving all of this process. The second thing that happens is all those electrons end up on carbon dioxide, converting it into a sugar, and those sugars are then interconverted into all the rest in autotrophic plants and so on, converted into all the rest of the organic molecules that we need to live, that they need to live, that we need to eat. So growth, basically, is both power and growth are coming from photosynthesis.
Can you remind us again, because this is more and more industrial, isn't it? But can you remind us again the size of these things, the size on which they're operating?
Yeah.
Is there any way of explaining it graphically?
It's kind of difficult to grasp, but the chloroplast itself is the size of a bacterium. It was a bacterium. So you can't really see it except down a microscope. Down a microscope, you can see them. Down a light microscope, you can see them quite well. So you could, if you have a reasonable microscope at home, you could see them. But they're in the order of, a fraction of a millimetre, something like a tenth of a millimetre or so in their length. This is the chloroplast. This is the engine house where all this is happening. Beyond that, within the chloroplast itself, you have these big proteins within the membranes themselves. Now, these are what I was calling the industrial complexes before. And if you shrink yourself down to the size of a molecule like oxygen, then really it's like a city. Now, there are tens of thousands of these great industrial complexes within a single chloroplast. So it's very difficult to grasp this scale, that something so small is in fact practically a city in itself.
I was just going to say that if you buy Spirogyra, which is one of these health food things from the health food store, and then wet it up and look at it with a lens, they have really big chloroplasts, and you can see them, and they're like little green oblong things. They're really rather beautiful chloroplasts.
John Allen, photosynthesis is just one of the chemical processes in the plant. Another's respiration. Can you tell us how these relate to each other, please?
Well, that's a good question. You know, Sandy's definition of photosynthesis is release of oxygen and uptake of carbon dioxide. This is good. This is correct. This is what plants do. Sorry. there is another view, which maybe come to. And if you take that view, aerobic respiration, which is respiration that plants do and which we do, we're all doing it now, is the uptake of oxygen. You put electrons onto it to make water, so it's the reverse of taking electrons from water to liberate oxygen. We take up oxygen, take a deep breath here, and we respire to make ATP by exactly the process that Nick just described. And in that process, we release carbon dioxide. So photosynthesis is release of oxygen, uptake of carbon dioxide. Respiration is uptake of oxygen, release of carbon dioxide, which we're all doing now. And all heterotrophs, we're all heterotrophs sitting around here, respiring and getting our energy from sunlight, stored by photosynthesis. So from Sandy's point of view, respiration and photosynthesis are the reverse of each other. I'm just using you as a token for this entirely correct botanical description. However, if you look more deeply at the kind of level that Nick is describing, the process of energy transduction, we could say a power station is a good analogy. It could be a medieval power station, like a water mill or something, converting energy from one form into a different form. The way in which that is done is universal in biology, and photosynthesis and respiration are two ways of applying that same fundamental mechanism: electron transport, moving protons across a membrane to make a gradient, which is stored energy and used to make ATP. So in that sense, they're the same process, except that the chlorophyll in the photosynthetic reaction center gives the electron that initial push that it needs. In respiration, the electrons just sort of flow where they want to go.
Nick Lane.
Yeah, the source of electrons is really the major difference between photosynthesis and respiration. So in respiration, we need an easy source of electrons. That's food in our own case. And the food will react spontaneously with oxygen. It doesn't happen right now because there are barriers to it happening, but in terms of the thermodynamics, they want to react with each other, and it will happen. And the enzymes in the mitochondria allow that to happen. What's happening in photosynthesis is that light is providing that essential input of energy, which starts electrons flowing from far more difficult places. So water, in this case. So water really does not want to lose its electrons, but the input of light through chlorophyll extracts electrons from it and sets them flowing in exactly the same way that they flow from food to oxygen in us. It's exactly the same processes. The source of electrons differs.
I'm still reading for this thing that's a tenth of the smallest thing I can properly think of, has cities inside it. But on we go. Sandinap, the plants and bacteria live in a wide variety of habitats. What are the limiting factors on? Are there any on photosynthesis and its efficiency?
There are certainly limiting factors. If there's no water in the environment, plants can't photosynthesize, nothing can photosynthesize because water is one of those inputs. Same is true for carbon dioxide. Same is also true for light. But there are also limits in things like nitrogen and phosphorus, which is part of the reason that we fertilize crops, is to increase photosynthetic efficiency and thereby increase yield, that you need the nitrogen and the phosphorus to build the other enzymes that operate in this little factory. But temperature is a very important limiting factor for photosynthesis as well. At very high temperatures, photosynthesis doesn't happen particularly efficiently, and at very low temperatures. So there's an optimum range. And one of the things that's really interesting about plants is that people often think of plants as just sitting there. Right? Plants just sit there and kind of do... But plants behave. It's just on a very different scale to our human behavior. And so if there's not enough water or if there's too much light, the stomates will close and thereby no carbon dioxide is taken in and photosynthesis go down. So plants regulate the degree to which they photosynthesize dependent on various environmental conditions, the most important of which are probably water and carbon dioxide concentration, which is interesting in the context of climate change. It's interesting in the context of the differing carbon dioxide concentrations over the history of life on Earth.
And John Allen again, chlorophyll isn't the only pigment. That's the pigment that gives us green, gives us our green, more chlorophyll. Are there others as important?
Well, there are others that serve to collect the light energy and ultimately deliver it to this special chlorophyll that loses its electron, which starts the whole process. There are carotenoids. These don't engage in this chemical reaction, but they absorb light and the energy is transferred into this sort of pinball game of chlorophyll molecules where it finally ends up in one special one. There are other pigment molecules, the cyanobacteria, for example, and red algae, which are eukaryotic, which are plants. These have pigments which absorb light energy, which is used for photosynthesis, again, essentially by chlorophyll. But these pigments are, I mentioned these four rings. These are linear tetrapyrroles rather than cyclic tetrapyrroles. So there's a whole range of different pigments that different photosynthetic organisms have sort of latched onto and exploited if they're useful for capturing and concentrating light energy.
Why is chlorophyll green?
That's such a good question, and you know, I have to confess, I don't know the answer. Lots of people have asked that question. Why is it green?
They're rushing in.
It's not green. We see it as green because green is the only thing that isn't absorbed. Green is the only wavelength that isn't absorbed. So nothing really has colour. We just perceive it because of the wavelength of light which is reflected off it. So chlorophyll's it's interesting. There's a concept called chlorophyllia, which is about the love of green things, which I think is a nice thing to be.
I think John wants a little word here.
Okay, why is chlorophyll green? Because it absorbs blue light and red light and doesn't absorb light in the middle of the visible spectrum, which is green. I mean, that's true. But that's just sort of stating... Oh, not starting an argument here. I mean,
no,
Melvin's question, if I may, could be rephrased. Why aren't plants black? Right? If they were black, they would be absorbing all visible light.
We could start again.
No. Why are they green? I mean, why are they not making use of green light? They should, really, if they were interested in getting the most energy, they would use the whole of the visible spectrum and would be mm-hmm. black, and they're not. So that's a question still.
Nick, have you got the answer?
No, but I have a small contribution. I mean, it's interesting that they use red light mostly. So the spectrum of light that chlorophyll is absorbing, which is taking the electrons from water and driving the whole process, is red light, which is not energetically particularly strong. Blue light has far more energy in it than red light does. So you would have thought from first principles that, and actually chlorophyll does absorb blue light as well, as John said, but it's not using that wavelength. And the reason is not clear, but it may simply be the destructiveness of UV and blue light. You know, it can damage our own retinas and so on as well. There are issues with higher energy wavelengths of light. So I think it's ended up with red, partly because that's the wavelengths that chlorophyll absorbs, and partly because selection has adapted the wavelengths that chlorophyll absorbs to being the gentlest on the plant itself. It's less likely to do damage if you're absorbing light at that wavelength.
Could we move on to a section on evolution, if we could, starting with you, Sandy? How has the need to photosynthesize influenced the evolution of plants in different sort of environments?
Well, because all plants need to photosynthesize to make their own food to live, and what's really interesting is plants in all kinds of places photosynthesize. So think about the back of caves. The back of deep caves have photosynthetic organisms in them. And so what has happened over the course of evolution is that plants that occur in particular areas have developed structural elements of how the leaves are you could say optimize, but they make photosynthesis possible. So think about a plant, for example, in the very dark rainforest understory. The light that comes in there is mostly those very long wavelengths, the red wavelengths, but it only comes in sunflex. And many plants in the rainforest understory have a red layer on the underside of the leaves. And people for a long time wondered why this was. And it's actually very striking in deep rainforest plants. And David Lee did some work in the 1970s and published a really nice paper where they showed that what happens in this anthocyanin layer is that it reflects light back into the chloroplast, so that they get more of that of the little light that's coming through. They get a bit more. Anthocyanins are pigments that we see as red, so they're absorbing everything except the red. But anthocyanins, so they're reflecting it back into the chloroplast in those rainforest plants. But they also protect chloroplasts from excess light in very high light environments. So plants do a huge number of different things with the pigments in their cells and the structure of the cells which focus light in that are all driven by evolution. Because if you think about it, what evolution is doing is it's maximizing the production of offspring. So if you are a plant and you photosynthesize well, grow well, produce lots of seeds, the genes that you have, the characteristics that you have, will be passed on to your offspring, which is how evolution gets driven. An individual plant doesn't necessarily evolve during its life. It's all done through reproduction to the next generation. And you think about the diversity of structure in plants. That's really driven by the ability to make food and grow in different kinds of ways.
Nick Lang, what do we know about the evolutionary history of photosynthesis itself? When's it thought to have emerged?
Well, there's quite a lot of controversy. It arose probably the very first forms very early on, 3.5 billion years ago. But those forms did not use water as the electron donor. They used things like hydrogen sulfide and iron. And the products that they produce, so if you're using iron as an electron donor, what you're leaving behind is rusty iron, which precipitates out of the oceans and forms banded iron formations, which are the major sources of iron ore that we're using today. So, you know, some of the big mineral deposits derive from photosynthesis and are evidence that photosynthesis was happening at that time. Oxygenic photosynthesis, so this is splitting water and releasing the toxic waste oxygen, probably arose between 2.5 and 3 billion years ago. It's difficult to constrain that. There's arguments about it. The arguments are based on the ratios of different isotopes of different atoms. It's quite abstruse. And we have to assume that measurements taken in one rock in one place are in some way representative of the whole planet, which is usually not true. So there's all kinds of difficulties with constraining. We know for sure it happened, as John said, by 2.4 billion years ago, because we see this tremendous catastrophe. So we have a snowball Earth at that time. The entire planet froze over.
What time are we on now?
We're about 2.4 billion years ago.
Right.
So there have been several episodes of these snowball Earths across Earth history. Probably what happened there was, as oxygen was being released, it oxidized the methane being produced by other bacteria. And methane is a greenhouse gas, and as it's stripped out of the atmosphere, the temperatures plummet. And the other thing we see around that time is the oxidation of rocks and so on the continent. So we see what are called red beds, basically rusty iron everywhere.
John Allen, can I come back to you again? I talked about the structures in plant cells known as chloroplasts. In evolutionary terms, how did plants gain these structures and when?
Well, they acquired them. It's a sort of question of mergers and acquisitions, and the chloroplasts were cyanobacteria. A larger cell discovered that if it entered into an intimate partnership with a cyanobacterium, it had a free supply of food and also oxygen for its own respiration. I think there's really no doubt about that now. When I was an undergraduate student, this was regarded as a sort of slightly flaky left-field proposition, you know. But now, for all sorts of reasons, there's really no escape from the fact that the chloroplast originated as an endosymbiont, a symbiont within the cell, and that symbiont resembled very closely what we know today as cyanobacteria.
Are you giving us any date for this? Within a sort of 700 million year or something like that?
Well, I think Nick already said 1.5 billion, and I'd go with that. That's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard. There are no fossils of this kind of thing to date in rocks, but it must have happened. Various reasons for thinking it must have happened.
Nick, can I stand it? Well, one of you. The emergence of the first... this is important for me anyway. Emergence of the first photosynthetic organisms. How did it affect the later development of life on Earth?
I mentioned the snowball Earth and the great oxidation event and so on. After that, 10-20 years ago, we would have thought, or we did think, that once oxygen levels started picking up in the atmosphere, everything should have changed. But actually, it didn't. It got stuck in a rut for another billion years or so.
The billion boring years.
The boring billion, it's called, yes. So nothing really happened. Actually, complex cells arose in that time. As John was saying, the acquisition of chloroplasts and so on happened in that time. But there's very little in the fossil record. We do see fossils, but we can't really constrain the sequence of events that happened. But then, at the end of this boring billion, we go into another global upheaval of more snowball Earths and so on. And then right on the back of that is the Cambrian explosion and the appearance of animals, really for the first time in the fossil record. Now, there's, again, lots of debates about what was happening, but one thing we're fairly certain about is that oxygen was produced at that time by plants and terrestrial algae and so on, rather than just cyanobacteria, and that gave the animals the energy they needed.
And that time is?
Well, the Cambrian explosion is just over half a billion years ago, 550 million years ago.
So we're getting closer.
Yes. It's remarkable that for three and a half billion years of Earth history, it's bacteria and very simple cells. And then suddenly, with the Cambrian explosion, you see the first real animals.
Standing up, would you give us some sense of the place that photosynthesis has in ecosystems in general and that in the Earth as a whole?
Well, I think photosynthesis itself, as we said, drives life on Earth, essentially. So it drives ecosystems, and it probably drives the composition of ecosystems as well. If you think of what an ecosystem is, it's all the organisms in a place and their relationships between them. And because so many heterotrophs depend upon autotrophs, which are these photosynthesizing organisms for their daily lives and their food, and then other heterotrophs depend upon those, so we depend on We eat beef, which is a heterotroph, which is eating grass, so we actually are eating sunlight via this complicated sort of chain of things.
It's a bit of isn't it, really?
Yeah, basically, sort of. But I think so really photosynthesis is driving structural complexity in plants because of evolving structural complexity to be able to co-occur and harvest light, which is a resource. And then those relationships between things that live on those plants are also driven by that complexity of plants. So it's a tangled web, as Darwin said.
John Allen, when did scientists first start to investigate the process of photosynthesis?
Well, you know, the great step in chemistry and biology was Joseph Priestley, about whom Nick has written in his book Oxygen. And in 1772, Priestley published a paper, an investigation of different kinds of air, because he knew some sort of air is necessary for life, and other sorts of air would extinguish life. And so the discovery of photosynthesis is, with good reason, ticked off to Priestley in 1772.
And the mouse?
And the mouse?
Priestley's mouse.
The mouse in the bell jar.
The mouse in the bell jar.
I've got a minute quote here. Do we have time for this?
Well, we have to rush. Maybe you could... It's a big
one. I flatter myself that I have accidentally hit upon a method of restoring air which has been injured by the burning of candles, and that I have discovered at least one of the restoratives which nature employs for this purpose. It is vegetation. One might have imagined that since common air is necessary to vegetable as well as animal life, both plants and animals had affected it in the same manner, and I own that I had that expectation when I first put a sprig of mint into a glass jar standing inverted in a vessel of water. But when it had continued growing there for some months, I found that the air would neither extinguish a candle, nor was it at all inconvenient to a mouse which I put into it. That's so the discovery of oxygen and the discovery of photosynthesis in one experiment.
What a wonderful way to end. Thank you very much. You got it all in, John. Thank you very much. Thanks very much to John Allen, Santa Knapp and Nick Lane. Next week we'll be talking about the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
Very long and complex process.
Did we leave anything essential out, John?
Yes, I think. I mean,
oh, I wish I hadn't asked you that.
No. I mean, I agree with everything said, and I appear to be slightly start an argument with Sandy in that. I hope that doesn't come over in that way.
No, it wasn't an argument, it's just a different perspective.
The point really is autotrophs, right? You're absolutely correct. I mean, but you did say early on all photosynthetic organisms are autotrophic, they build themselves up. Not true. Microbiologists would insist, and in fact,
yeah, that's true. That's true. You're right.
So I'm okay for sort of banging on just a little bit. Now we're off air, right?
You must be told this little extra bit goes on as a PS in the podcast.
Okay. Well, just
I think they can live with it.
Just tell me if this gets boring. Look, there are two things you can ask.
We've been bored for a billion years now. What's a few minutes?
There are two things you can ask about any living creature. Number one, where does it get its energy? Right? Is it a phototroph getting its energy from light? Or is it a chemotroph getting its energy from food it eats? Right? So that's energy, phototroph.
So I'm just out of date with autotrophs.
No, you're not out of date at all. No, you're absolutely bang on. So that's the energy. Now, photosynthetic organisms are phototrophs, but they don't have to be autotrophs because they can get the energy and still eat food.
I think that might be too complex for a taxonomist. That's too much of a taxonomy of trophs.
No, I'm really not. I'm not trying. Absolutely
I'm
not
you,
trying
John.
To pull.
I'm teasing you.
I would not wish to pull rank. I am humble before a plant taxonomist who actually knows about plants. I do assure you. But the second thing you can ask about any living organism is where does it get its stuff that it makes itself from? Does it apparently get it from nowhere? Well, actually, we know pluck it from the air. It's then an autotroph. Or does it get it from other living things? Heterotroph, other feeding. That's a possibility. We're all heterotrophs. No, there are photoheterotrophs that get their energy from light, but they still eat food. They need other organic compounds to assimilate. The other thing that we're almost there, the other obverse of that is there are also autotrophs, which are organisms which not interested in light. They live deep in rocks.
Are those the vents?
They're chemoautotrophs that get their energy from chemical reactions, but they fix CO2 and make carbohydrates, just like photosynthesis.
But that's a bit of a wider context.
That's all, Sandy.
I think that's what always amazes me is that life on Earth is absolutely incredible. The number of different ways in which organisms make their living, grow, survive,
when
and
I walk through London, I feel amazing. The same every yes. time I look in.
It reminds me of the banking crisis. Actually,
Dr. Johnson said that way people make a living. Yeah.
Nothing ever.
I didn't
changes.
Think we said enough about the sun. And how fascinating it is that all the early civilizations, whether it's Ra in Egypt or the sun god in the Aztecs, they had it bang on from the beginning, didn't they? They knew what created life.
They had some immediate perception that the sun was the source of all life.
Well, of course, when it rises,
life begins. And the seasons, of course, away from the equatorial reasons, you worship the sun when it begins to appear and exert its strength in the spring. It's remarkable, isn't it? Yes, I think it's a human.
Well, the correlation between the sun and growth, especially in temperate zones, it's got to be very obvious.
I mean, one of the things I don't think I quite got across is that, you think plants produce oxygen, animals consume oxygen, but that's a complete balance. And so nothing changes. That's why you have that boring billion. It's only when, if we die and we're buried and we are not then kind of broken back down and to CO2 and oxygen again and water again, if we're just buried intact as a fossil fuel in effect, then the oxygen that would have oxidized you is left over in the air. And so the dynamic over evolutionary time is nothing to do with how much photosynthesis there is, it's to do with how much carbon is buried. So it's a geological process rather than really a biological process.
Do you think it would help the world if we all got buried?
Yes.
Rather than
they said we'd end up with lots of oxygen in the atmosphere and everything would burn.
Bring on burial.
Tom's arrived.
So you're now off the hook. It's tea or coffee, really.
There are many more Radio 4 arts and discussion programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.